with Bush family members and four other best-selling authors. As he pulled away from the White House in a long blue limousine, he told his co-author, Ron Hall, "I done gone from living in the bushes to eating with the bushes. God bless America," he exclaimed. "This is a great country." Since 2005, Denver spoke at more than 400 fundraising events, radio and TV shows in more than 250 cities. He attained rock star status with his fans, but the only introduction he ever wanted was, "Tell 'em I'm a nobody that is trying to tell everybody about somebody that can save anybody." And he did. That somebody was Jesus. And Denver woke up in his arms on Saturday. His famous quote and the final words in his book are, "We are all homeless, just working our way home. Welcome home, friend. You are a good and faithful servant." He is survived by two daughters, Tracy and Marva, and two sons, Thomas and Kirk. The years have passed so quickly, it seems like only yesterday that Debbie had her dream and we had our first life-changing and, might I add, fearful encounter with the man in her dream. Now the world knows her dream was real. Denver was, in fact, a poor, wise man who would change our city and countless cities all across America. For my children and my four granddaughters, through our film and books, I wanted to document Debbie's legacy so they would know what a difference she made in the lives of millions. And for Denver's family, I want them to know the man they never really knew and be proud of his redemption and accomplishments. I want to leave you with a few words straight from the mouth of Denver, the wise man. These were spoken directly to me on one of the first days I spent walking the streets with him in his neighborhood. I made a derogatory comment about one of his friends when Denver stopped, stared into my eyes, and began to school me. "Mr. Ron, you can't judge people by what they do or what they have. You got to judge them by what they've been through. And you ain't gonna know what they've been through lessen you cares enough to ask. But if the truth was to really come out, God don't need no more judges. He's got courthouses full of them. What God does need is servants. I pray you will become one." "Mr. Ron, sometimes rich folks like you rise up so high trying to get yourself more stuff that you miss getting to know God. But you can never stoop too low to help somebody and have God miss knowing about you. My prayer for you, our readers, is that you will become servants and not miss the opportunity to stoop low and help somebody. Rest in peace, my wise friend and my beautiful wife." Making the Movie. The making of Same Kind of Different as Me, the movie, could be a completely separate film, filled with betrayal, heartaches, failures, and vastly ranging emotions from the mire to the choir. An old art dealer buddy often told me, "Sometimes you are the statue, and sometimes you are the pigeon." This movie-making business has kept me perpetually as the statue. But just as the death of a dream seemed imminent, life supports were unplugged and last rites spoken over this project, a hero arrived. Actually, more than one, not to mention a guiding hand from above the entire time. But I'm getting far ahead of myself. It all began in spring 2007. Our book had been on the shelves for 9 months, but was struggling to find an audience. First-time authors telling personal stories have a particularly hard time getting published and an even harder time being advertised and promoted. One day after receiving several rejections from book clubs and fairs, Denver recognized my state of depression. "Mr. Ron, We didn't write this book for no book clubs, fairs, or TV shows. We wrote it for Miss Debbie, and more important than that, we wrote it for God. So quit asking folks to do something for our book. As of right now, we're just going to shut up and give it over to God and let him take care of his business and the book, and us are going to be just fine. So we did. A few days later, we were in Tampa, Florida, driving across the Sunshine Skyway Bridge over Tampa Bay after being on the Joy FM Morning Cruise radio talk show. My cell phone lit up with a California area code showing on the screen. Is this Ron Hall, who wrote Same Kind of Different as Me? Mark Clayman, who had produced one of Denver's and my favorite films, The Pursuit of Happiness, was on the line. This book will make a great movie, and I want to option it and produce the movie, he exclaimed as I fist-bumped Denver and Carmen Brown, the radio host. Our book had been passed along to Mark, third or fourth hand, from one of Debbie and my best friends in Dallas, who gave it to a friend in L.A. It took me all of 2 seconds to agree to let him pick up the ball and run with it. And run with it, he did. Things started to happen quickly. In a matter of months, we had a screenplay and Samuel L. Jackson attached to play Denver. I have since learned it takes an average of 7 years to develop and shoot a film. However, after more than 2 years and no movie, Mark and his partners graciously allowed me out of my contract to pursue other options. For by now, I thought I knew a little bit about the movie business. Just as I did when I wrote my draft for the original book. I studied great writers and read award-winning books. So I figured that at my age, I needed to get on a fast learning curve if I were ever to make a movie. I watched great films, read Oscar-winning screenplays, and dreamed big dreams. I looked at the great filmmakers, and paraphrasing a quote that I read at the time, learned that it takes passion, patience, and perseverance to be a filmmaker. The only one of the three that I lacked was patience, and I'm afraid I'll never learn that one. Looking back on my first shot at making a film, I joked to friends that I should have been studying the film and screenplay for Titanic, as it took 3 years to build and just hours to sink to the bottom. With passion and perseverance still in my camp, I optioned our book once again, this time to a major studio and famous producer. I was preparing my Oscar speech before the ink on the contract was dry, but after months of problems, I was eating humble pie. The screenplay had taken a turn that disturbed me so badly, I ripped it in half and returned it with a cover letter saying only, "Our truth is better than your fiction." I could not let this become our film. The heart and soul had been slashed from Debbie's and Denver's story of hope and redemption, and I was back aboard the Titanic with nothing in my lifeboat but a pile of legal bills. Denver took it all in stride, never really believing he would be a movie star and certainly not wanting any more notoriety, even though it had saved him a few traffic tickets. But as always, he offered up one of his pearls to console me. "Mr. Ron, if the devil ain't messing with you, he's already got you." My prayer had always been not to make a movie just to tell our story, but to make a movie that would both entertain and, more importantly, change the way the world looks at the homeless. Early on, I wanted somehow to blend film and philanthropy. I wanted to make the type of film that becomes a movement. The producer was still passionate about our story and not happy himself with the last screenwriter, who had taken it into fantasy land. As we talked, he was convinced I would never be happy with anyone else telling our story and that I should write the screenplay myself. My initial reaction was hesitation and doubt in my ability to crack our story, using few words in a format I'd never attempted. My friend reminded me I had never attempted to write a book before either, and it somehow became a platinum New York Times bestseller. I hung up the phone and picked up my pen. Near the end of my first option period with Mark Klayman, there was a doctor who, at the insistence of his wife, read our book and probably in the interest of family unity, listened to the small, gentle voice of his wife and flew into Dallas to meet with Denver and me. He brought with him a young producer, Darren Moorman, who, through lots of twists and turns, eventually became a producer on our film. Darren and the doctor brought their wives, who spent the day gathering pearls from Denver and throwing out ideas for making the movie. At the end of the day, I took them back to their private plane, and we agreed to be friends and stay in touch, though the possibility of doing business with them was very slim since I was currently in an option agreement elsewhere. The doctor felt I needed someone who had my back as I swam in the shark tank of filmmaking, and so he offered that as a gift to me, which I gladly accepted. Near the end of my second option period, the doctor introduced me to his lawyer friend, who had also read our book at the insistence of his wife. I was drowning in legal bills with slim hope of settlement. They offered to help me get across the finish line without breaking the bank with legal fees. This seemed, at the time, like an answered prayer. Within a matter of weeks, once again, I had escaped the clutch of a studio that did not share my vision. With my passion and persistence still alive and well, and my patience lagging way behind, I prayed for and began exploring ideas for an independent film. I'd become convinced this was the only route that allowed me to control content. About this time, I ran across the following quote from director Adam Green. "You may love football, but that doesn't mean you have any business trying to play the sport. It's the same thing in filmmaking. Everybody has a great idea for a movie, but do you have the stamina to get good at your craft and deal with how heartbreaking it is? And I would add, do you have the financial recourses to battle the giants?" Filmmaking, as I have discovered, is a 24/7 commitment to a project that generates zero income until tickets and popcorn. And if you follow trade reports, only a small percentage of films ever show a profit. It's a crazy business that makes selling art look easy, and I personally know how difficult that is. Within weeks, I had written a 157-page screenplay that I believed was a winner. My producer friend politely informed me that it was long enough for a miniseries, and I needed help. He did say I had cracked the code for Denver's voice that two previous attempts had failed to achieve, but surprisingly, I had failed at nailing down my own. He suggested bringing in a real screenwriter to smooth out the rough spots and put a nice shine on it, and in the process, work in some magic. Being stubborn, for the next several months I wrote seven more versions before raising my surrender flag. Enter Michael Carney and Alex Ford, screenwriting partners from L.A. Michael had been informed about our project by my lawyer friend, but was not interested in becoming involved in a faith-based project, which can often be the kiss of death for aspiring Hollywood types. He was mentioning the quandary to his father on the phone one day, and everything changed when he mentioned the name of our book. What he didn't know was that his father, a pastor, had purchased nearly 400 of our books and passed them out to his church and friends in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Heeding his father's advice, he and Alex made the trip to Dallas. "Whose story is this?" was their first question to me. "Debbie's and Denver's," I answered. "They are in heaven. Who is left to tell it?" As I had traveled across America for more than 10 years telling our story, I had always told my audience that I was privileged to have been a witness to this great story, but if the truth were known, I was merely Debbie's and Denver's storyteller. My original screenplay was written from Denver's voice, but he could no longer speak for himself. Michael and Alex convinced me that the rewrite should be from my voice. So it was. There were so many characters in the book, friends, family, mission volunteers, and God's people, according to Debbie, that it shaped our story, and I wanted to include them all. That's how I ended up with 157 pages. What characters drive the story? Was the question asked over and over as we faced the intimidation of the page. My father Earl and our poor relationship was not a central theme in the original book, but a theme that was prevalent in my life and spiritual journey that we featured in our second book. Denver was the catalyst in our reconciliation. He convinced me to spray some Windex on a soft cloth and wipe off my rearview mirror, reflecting a man who needed to forgive his father. Michael and Alex convinced me that the audience needed to see how important Denver was in both mine and Debbie's, and even my old racist father's lives. Now, having seen this played out in the film, I see their brilliance as I watch Oscar winner John Voight play Earl so brilliantly one would have thought he'd robbed the grave and brought him back to life to play himself. Meanwhile, news of my previous failures spread like wildfire in the West Texas tumbleweeds. My phone was ringing constantly with filmmakers, big and small, offering ideas on how to get this story up on the big screen. Since I had made enough bad decisions, the doctor and lawyer offered to vet these calls, and I agreed. Things were going swimmingly as the three of us met and discussed how three Christian guys with zero experience in filmmaking could break into a business not too welcoming to our types. After a series of financial setbacks, I was nearly broke. They proposed we form a partnership that would have my back and cover my cash flow shortages. For $5,000, I sold them two-thirds of my book, life, and movie rights. There is an old cowboy saying that good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment. 1 year after signing away my rights, my new friends attempted a hostile takeover. After professing much love for me and concern that I was making a huge mistake, the doctor and lawyer had prayerfully come to a decision to let me join them in taking the film in a direction of their choosing, which included scrapping our screenplay and firing Michael, Alex, and Darren. I was shocked, as I had just raised more than $3 million from my friends to make the movie I dreamed of making. My partners had not, and were not, willing to contribute or raise funds for the project, claiming it would not be prudent of them to invest their own money or that of their friends. However, they did offer to buy me out, as they had come to realize after 1 year of conversations that our project had value. I flatly refused, stating emphatically that I was not for sale, and this was, in fact, my life and my project. They felt otherwise, and asked me to read the contract I had signed, giving them two-thirds control. After several days of prayer and whatever else they were doing, they came back to me with an offer to sell out to me for $525,000 payable in cash in 30 days, or they were taking over. With just 30 days to pay, I put on my knee pads and dusted off my MBA. Mortgaging the ranch came to mind first, but I realized I'd given it to my children. Then, out of nowhere, a Bentley-driving Christian leader appeared on my doorstep, bearing gold, frankincense, and myrrh. According to him, his word was solid, and he would pay the $525,000 on the appointed day in exchange for a 10% interest in the profits. As I said earlier, the story of making this movie is almost as involved as the movie itself. Many have asked me how a supposedly wealthy art dealer cannot write a check for $500,000. The operative word is supposedly. 5 years earlier, I could have written that check many times over. But after a bout of bad judgment regarding investment decisions and a former art dealer, now serving 18 years in prison, my life savings had disappeared in a pile of dust. My wife, Beth, and I were so relieved and confident that 2 days before the money had to be paid, we took off on a road trip from Dallas to Charleston to visit her family and scout movie locations along the way. I especially wanted her to see the Louisiana plantation where Denver picked the man's cotton. I had not been back there in a few years and was saddened to see Denver's and Herschelie's houses had been burned to the ground. I once had the idea to buy them and make them historic sites for his fans, but that dream had gone up in flames. We spoke to our new partner daily, and of course everything was on track with the man whose word was apparently golden. On the final day that I would lose control if the money was not paid, our Bentley-driving savior simply evaporated, without so much as a sorry, or even the courtesy of answering his phone. Beth and I sat in the parking lot of the Dunleith Plantation in Natchez, Mississippi, in the speechless type of shock that defies any further description. We had 1 hour for a miracle. I called my bank and took $200,000 from my 92-year-old mother's savings account and wired it to my partners as a non-refundable offering to give me a 5-day extension to come up with the balance. I am grateful that they accepted that. Then Beth suggested calling a friend that had promised to invest in our film and ask him for the money. I dialed his number, never expecting him to answer, much less bail me out, but his immediate response was, "Thank you for calling, and I will do what it takes for you to get back in control of Debbie's and Denver's story." His word was solid gold, unlike the fool's gold we had been promised earlier. Beth reminded me of our friend Denver, always telling me that if the devil ain't messing with you, he's already got you. The devil had taken us to hell and back, but God saved us. This wasn't the money for the film itself, but the necessary funds to once again get control of my own story. There was still a battle ahead, but the relief was indescribable. My resolve was greater than ever to make an inspiring film and tell the story I wanted to tell. My first call was to invite Michael to be the director and for Michael, Alex, and Darren to be my producing partners along with me. One hitch, everyone had to work for no pay until the cameras started rolling. All agreed, because all of us had already worked more than a year without expense money or a check, and Denver used to say, "Hunger would drive a man to work that ain't got no car." It was now late in the day. Beth and I were still sitting in our car in the same parking lot of the plantation in Natchez, conflicted between elation and exhaustion, as we debated whether or not to check in and spend $170 for the night. Exhaustion won the toss, and we checked in. As we unpacked the car and carried luggage to our room, an attractive middle-aged couple rode up on a Harley and parked next to us. I jokingly asked Beth if a Harley might be in our future, and she looked at me as if I had suffered brain damage from the roller coaster ride we had been on all day. Later that evening, we sat at a high-top table at the historic Bowie's Tavern overlooking the Mississippi River. We were enjoying a glass of wine and deconstructing how we had gotten ourselves in such a mess and where we were going from here when Mr. and Mrs. Motorcycle sat down at the table next to us. After about an hour, the wife got up to use the restroom, and I leaned over in a southern, friendly sort of way to tell the guy his motorcycle looked like fun. He laughed and asked, "Where are you guys from?" "Dallas." "What are you doing in Natchez?" "Scouting movie locations." "What's the name of your movie?" "Same kind of different as me." "No way," he replied with a big grin. "That's my wife's and my favorite book." "I'm the author," I continued as his wife walked back up to the table. "Honey, this is the author of Same Kind of Different as Me." "And what difference do it make?" she quickly added. Sounds like you read both, I said, accepting the nice compliment. Come join us at our table. I'm David Landrum, and this is my wife, Jill. We're from Jackson. We moved to their table, and God took over. David proceeded to tell me that one of his good friends in Jackson was one of our biggest fans. Stephen Johnston? I asked. Absolutely. How did you know? David replied. I was talking to Darren Moorman, one of our producers, this afternoon, and he said if we were near Jackson, we should try to meet him. Darren had sat next to one of his employees who was reading our book on an airplane a couple of years ago and heard the same story about Stephen, but had not met him. David went on to tell us that he and Stephen heard we were making a movie, and they had recently called my partners, now ex-partners, about investing. According to Stephen, my partners were curt and not interested in him or his money, and the subject was dropped. And yet here we sat, just somehow running into them. Debbie and Denver would say that God's hand was guiding in a very clear way. So are you still making a movie? Absolutely. What do you need? Money? How much? I'm trying to raise another $5 million. You guys still interested? I asked with a wink. Probably. Let's get Stephen on the phone, he responded while he dialed his cell phone. I sat there in shock. David proceeded to sell us on the idea of filming in Mississippi. He went so far as to promise that if we filmed there, he and Stephen would raise the $5 million in Jackson. Things were moving faster at Bowie's Tavern than they had in the last 7 years. David promised a meeting with Governor Phil Bryant, Stephen Johnston, potential investors, and the Film Commission the following Monday. As crazy as this sounds, 1 hour after moving to David and Jill's table, we were shaking hands on a movie deal to be shot in Mississippi. The night was still young. David and Jill wanted to hear Denver stories, so that for the next couple of hours, I entertained them with stories of their hero. I shared with them countless pictures of Denver, Debbie, our family, and other heroes of our book that I keep on my cell phone for nights like this. They had planned to drive to Fort Worth to meet him at the mission and were saddened that they missed the opportunity. The bartender hollered last call and brought us one last round. We toasted over a glass of Cabernet, and I began to share the unbelievable tale of how just a few hours earlier we were on a sinking ship in the parking lot before God saved us. Not only did he save us, he planted us in Bowie's Tavern alongside David and Jill Landrum, who shared with us how our books had changed their lives. And now the handsome motorcycle couple that parked next to us that afternoon was about to change ours. It's crazy how God works. As we walked back to our rooms at midnight, David said, "Oh, I almost forgot. I meant to ask you whatever happened to Denver's friend, you know, the white guy. Art dealer." Could he be serious? I wondered, but obviously he was. With a sly grin, I answered, "I've never been asked that question, but I'll let you in on a little secret. You've been talking to him all night." 1 week later, as promised, we met with the governor, Stephen Johnston, and the Film Commission in Jackson. By mid-July, we had commitments for nearly $10 million. We met in L.A. with Creative Artists Agency and began our talent search. By mid-August, we had a handshake deal with Mary Parent and Paramount. We locked in October 27th, 2014, as the day we would begin principal photography. Digimon Hansu, a 2-time Oscar nominee, was the first cast member to commit in early August of 2014. 2 weeks later, Oscar winner John Voight came on board to play my father. In early September, Greg Kinnear read our screenplay and asked for a meeting in New York. We came away with a handshake deal and an urgent need for a female lead. We were 5 weeks out from cameras rolling in Jackson and on our knees praying that Oscar winner Renee Zellweger would give us a thumbs up. The next 2 sleepless weeks seemed like 2 years as I checked my email and cell phone virtually every minute, praying for an RZ to appear on the screen. Finally, God answered our prayers and our principal cast was complete. As a bonus, God blessed us with Olivia Holt, the young Disney star who signed with us for her first feature film to play my daughter, Reagan. 4 months after meeting David and Jill in Natchez, Beth and I moved to Jackson to begin pre-production. We wrapped on December 10th, 2014. All glory be to God. Now, like when Denver admonished me to give our book over to God, here we go again. God, the film is all yours.
You're listening to the audio production of Working Our Way Home, the incredible true story of a homeless ex-con and a grieving millionaire thrown together to save each other, by Ron Hall. Published by Thomas Nelson and read by Daniel Butler and Barry Scott.
Working Our Way Home. Dedication. I'm dedicating this book to the memory of my father, Earl Hall. In my first book, Same Kind of Different as Me, I wrote some unkind things about him. Though they were true, based on my understanding of his life, I own my part in the conflict we experienced, given that I never found a way to love him until Denver forced me to bless the hell out of him. It was then I discovered the father I'd wanted since my early childhood. I cherished the year we spent hanging out together the way best friends do and getting to know each other before he went to heaven at age 91. I've just finished writing our memoir that can best be described as Same Kind of Sorry as Me, an apology and a celebration. And to Denver, who moved into my home bringing nothing and gave me everything, I miss you. As Denver was the first face I saw every morning and the last almost every night for nearly 12 years, I know his voice as well as mine. I have tried to faithfully recapture it here as best I could. For more than 10 of those 12 years, we lived under the same roof and experienced the events and had the conversations I've written about in this book. Both are recounted as accurately as I remember them. Ron Hall, September 2017. Preface. I'm not really a betting man, though I am a gambler. That said, if you are reading this preface, you are probably one of the millions who read Same Kind of Different as Me, the first New York Times bestseller, co-authored by a skitzy, homeless ex-con known as Suicide, who could not read or write. If that's not the case, then let me say welcome. I hope you will join Suicide and me on this untold journey that straddles a Texas canyon between insanity and hilarity for a long tumble in the whitewater until tragedy shows its ugly head. And hopefully, after you have turned the last page and said, "Dang, that was fun," you will circle back to our first book and make some sense out of all this craziness. This story is for Debbie, who on her deathbed gave me a job to do, and for Beth, who years later encouraged me to write about it, then cracked the whip until I finished.
Chapter 1. I am traveling toward life's sunset gate. I'm a pilgrim going home. The sunset gate. I looked out over the crowd, mostly white folk. Wasn't nary a dry eye in the whole church. They was affecting me, and that ain't normal, 'cause I seldom makes eye contact, lest I be thinking about taking care of business, if you get my drift. I paused, trying to figure out what I was gonna say next. Maybe I done said enough. Seemed like I been talking about 30 minutes, then it come to me. I'm fixing to do something the devil ain't never done for you. I'm gonna cut you loose, but before I do, I'm gonna leave you with a little something to think about. Whether we is rich or whether we is poor, or something in between, this earth ain't no final resting place. So in a way, we is all homeless. ever last one of us, just working our way home. A rich-looking man about 50 years old on the front row stood up and pointed his finger at me. That shut me down. I thought I might have made the fella mad telling rich white folk they's homeless just like me. But the next thing I knowed, the lady next to him stood up. Then Mr. Ron and his family stood up. And before I knowed it, the whole crowd, maybe 1,000 or so, was on their feet clapping like they was at some kind of performance. I never really wanted to know Miss Debbie. Miss Debbie forced me to know her. That was the stubbornest woman I ever met, black or white. That ain't a lot for some skinny little white lady who wasn't scared of me, 'cause everybody else on the streets feared me. I made sure of that. I guess I'd have to say Miss Debbie was a stubborn angel, my angel, that I wasn't never looking for or never wanted. For the life of me, I never could quite figure the lady out. But she loved it me and never gave up on me. Sad to say, she died before she seen me as the man she wanted me to be. She used to tell me, "Denver, you got a calling on your life, and you're going to live to see it." That's why I be standing up here like a preacher in this big white folk church to honor that lady in front of all these rich white folk. They was even a few fellas like me and some street ladies from the mission. God's people, Miss Debbie called him. Miss Debbie wanted to bring about a change in my life. At least see me act a little nicer and help her help the homeless. Over and over, she kept telling me I had to change places and playgrounds, leave my past. Bossy. She even offered me to move in with her family. For sure, I wasn't going to be moving in with no rich white lady and her husband and kids and lose my status in the hood. I told her I was a bad man, but that lady was stone deaf to my objections. She say she didn't see no bad man. She seen a good heart. Seemed to me the lady was wearing Superman's glasses and was able to see plumb through all my anger and confusion to a heart only I knowed was locked up inside my scarred black skin. But now she's gone. I figure God needed her more in heaven than down here on the streets. God don't make no mistakes. Did you hear me? Now, Mr. Ron, well, I figured the onliest reason he was being my friend is 'cause Miss Debbie told him to. That man didn't never want to disappoint his wife or tell her no. He'd done something he was paying for. But now that she's gone, I figure he's gonna cut me loose and go about his life. We's friendly, but to tell you the truth, I don't let nobody, I said nobody, get close to me. Never have, never will. Although, Miss Debbie come real close. After the service, I slipped out the back door to avoid having to talk to nobody. I've always been skitsy about talking to folks, especially whites. I borrowed a suit to wear, a real nice one, so I wouldn't be an embarrassment to Miss Debbie's family. Now, what's a fella like me gonna do with a suit? I ain't got no place to go or no place to hang it. So I walk right back in the mission store and hung it back on the rack so it's there for someone else who need to look nice for just a day. The clothes I wore before the funeral that morning got thrown in the dumpster, which ain't no big deal since I ain't never bought no clothes. Not really. So I picked out a new pair of dark brown breeches and a brown belt to hold them up. A brown shirt, the same color, caught my eye, and I put it on. Then, quick as I slicked up for church, I slid back into my comfortable spot in the hobo jungle near the tracks. Unless you ever walked in my shoes, you wouldn't understand how I could stay in the bushes in a cardboard box surrounded by hoodlums, crooks, killers, and thieves. Nobody never trusted nobody in the hobo jungle. That's why you never see me without my baseball bat. I enforce my own brand of justice.
Why do you think everybody on the streets called me suicide? It wasn't 'cause I was a nice fella. That's called self-protectionism. I found a big piece of cardboard in the dumpster and laid down on the wet ground from the morning rain in the shade of a big old oak tree. I hadn't really slept in the last 3 days since Miss Debbie passed. When I closed my eyes, I'd just be thinking about Miss Debbie. Ain't nobody ever seen me cry, especially on the streets, where they thinks I'm the meanest man alive. So I put a rag over my head to hide my face from the other fellas that was laying up in the bushes. In fact, the last time I remember crying for that was when I was a little boy and watched Big Mama burn up in a fire. Tried to save her, but she just wouldn't wake up after taking them red devil pills. She was a large woman, top to bottom and back to front, too heavy for me to drag out. Them red and yellow flames looked like the devil himself was fanning them and killing her. I heard her crying out for Jesus as the roof came crashing down on her. That was the terriblest thing ever happened to me. You just don't never get over something so tragible like that. But here I was in just about the same spot I laid 40 years ago. 2 days after I hopped on a freight train as it was passing by the plantation. Life there was slow and easy. Listen to me. Ain't nothing more beautiful than a black land cotton field ready for the picking. Slimy green alligator-filled swamps lined with cypress trees don't sound too appealing to someone who ain't never sat on the bank with a fishing pole watching snakes slither and listening to the bullfrogs croak. Brings tears to my eyes thinking about the beauty and wonderment of Louisiana. About the beauty and wonderment of Louisiana. There was plenty of work for the coloreds till machinery took all the jobs. Wasn't long after that our peoples was forced into city slums with no money, no education, and no hope. I hung around longer than most, till the man cut everybody loose except the boss nigger. When he cut off my credit at his store, I just walked across the blacktop road and climbed up inside that boxcar. I smiled till I fell asleep. That was freedom. I'd never been more than 30 miles off of that Louisiana plantation. The man made sure of that. I know people on the outside say we were free, but on the inside, I felt like his slave. I had no idea where that freight train was going. A hobo laying up in there told me probably California. Didn't matter. I had plenty of time to get there. When that train finally come to a stop, I got off and walked right into this camp. It ain't changed much. I asked the fella where I was at, and he say Fort Worth, Texas. I knowed it wasn't California, but I figured it was a long way from the plantation. Too far for the man to come looking for me. The big city and me didn't get along very well. Too much confusion, hustling and running game. Things got bad in a hurry when a fella tried to rob me and shot me in the leg with a .357 mag. I ended up on another freight train, running and hiding from the law, 'cause I gave him a taste of his own medicine. A few days later, one of the hobos I was riding with say we was in Los Angeles. I stayed a pretty good while out there, but I ain't one to talk about that. There was a lot of allegations against me in that town, but the alligator didn't know the whole truth, so I eased on out of there on the next freight train going slow enough for me to hop on. I ended up back in Fort Worth and set up camp right here in the jungle. It was the onliest place I knowed. And to tell you the truth, I didn't have no other place to go. Still don't. This is where I began my new life, running from the past with a secret I didn't want nobody to find out. I've been carrying this secret, a lot of secrets, a long time. Ain't never told nobody, and hoped I never have to. Miss Debbie got me to start talking about my past, and I almost spilled the beans once or twice, 'cause she was the first person I ever trusted. but I still ain't told nobody. Now that she's gone, don't know if I ever will. But it's a load to carry. Did you hear what I said?
Chapter 2. I woke up to the news that George W. Bush had won the presidency. Just 3 weeks before, my wife, Debbie, and I had watched the last debate. Politics for her was a passion, and she was a big supporter of Bush. Now, she was gone. But knowing her, I would not doubt that some of her new friends in high places might have helped with the election. The kids and I were driving to the church, about an hour before the start of Debbie's memorial service. I dialed Denver's cell phone over and over, but he wasn't answering. He'd already lost 3 phones since Debbie gave him his first one a few months ago. This was not a good time to lose another one. Denver and I had talked early that morning as he drove back to Fort Worth from our ranch at Rocky Top. He said he was shaken with the chills and sadly would not be able to attend her service. Reluctantly, like it was a secret, he told me he had spent the whole night before keeping watch over Debbie's grave at the ranch, where we'd buried her the previous afternoon. I asked him why, since it had rained most of the night, a cold rain. But after living outside for so many years, he said the rain didn't bother him. It was cleansing, he said, adding he had prayed for Debbie's service the whole night long and wasn't going to stop until it was finished. I just couldn't accept that he wasn't coming, so I kept dialing his number, hoping he would answer, miraculously feeling better. He didn't. As we walked in the sanctuary and took our seats, through the blur and fog of my own tears, I visualized Debbie crying in heaven. One of her final special requests was for her dear friend, Denver, to say a few words at her service. There was a commotion at the back of the church. The crowd all seemed to turn their heads at once to see who was arriving as the preacher began reading Debbie's eulogy. I'd never seen him so freshly scrubbed, wearing a suit and tie with shoes that shined like a mirror. He looked shockingly handsome, in contrast to his preferred vagrant style. After 2 years, my heart and eyes were no strangers to this miracle transformation. For the next few minutes, a profound sadness lifted. Tears of joy flowed like the Brazos River as Denver walked down the aisle, followed by a few of Debbie's homeless friends, Mr. Ballantyne, Hal, and Clara, and 2 ladies I didn't know. Though Denver and I had been friends for nearly 2 years, I'd never heard him speak more than a few words of wisdom. He was the silent type and had been most of his life, according to him, but this was a good day to break his silence. He spoke like a graduate of a master speaking class, inciting nearly 1,000 mourners to stand and applaud, something I'd never seen nor heard of at a funeral. When he finished speaking, he slipped away as if he'd been an actor in a magician's illusion. The next morning, as my kids, Reagan and Carson, and I were packing our car, I got a call from Don Schisler, who ran the Union Gospel Mission where we'd first met Denver. Immediately after Debbie's service, he'd received several calls from her friends. They wanted to donate money to build the mission of Debbie's Dream, which Denver had spoken about at the service. Nearly $500,000 was already committed. I tried again to call Denver, but still no answer. I was uneasy about leaving for a week to decompress with my kids without at least letting him know. His words about friendship from one of our first meetings rang in my ears. I had asked him to be my friend, and he told me he'd have to think about it. A couple of weeks after that meeting, I spotted him on the streets, taking trash out of a dumpster and feeding the wild birds. I rolled down the window and asked him to go with me to Starbucks. Reluctantly, he slowly walked to the passenger side and opened the door without a word. When he first heard the cashier ring up and say, $4, please, he refused his cup, saying, coffee is free at the mission. Why pay for something that's free? A few moments later, sitting on the patio, he stared me in the eyes and said, I've been thinking a lot about what you asked me. What did I ask you that required any thought? I replied. You asked me if I'd be your friend.
Yes, I did. So what do you think? Before I decide if I was going to be your friend, I need to ask you a question about fishing. I don't fish much, Denver. In fact, I don't even own a rod and reel or a tackle box, so I'm not sure I can answer. Bet you can. He seemed to stare deep into my soul. Well, ask. I heard when white folks go fishing, they do this thing called catch and release. Yeah, of course they do. It's a sport. Don't you get it? No, sir. I sure don't. He went on to tell me that back on the plantation, they would go out in the morning, dig a can full of worms, cut a cane pole, and sit on the riverbank all day long. When they finally got something on the line, they were real proud of it. They would take it back to the plantation and share the catch with all the folks. Denver said, "So it occurred to me, if you is a white man that is fishing for a friend, and you're going to catch and release, then I ain't got no desire to be your friend." My body twitched at first, then relaxed as if an electrical shock or profound wisdom had coursed through my veins. Never had I heard something so wise from a scholar, much less an illiterate. My mind flashed back to Debbie's dream about a poor man who was wise, and by whose wisdom our lives and city would be changed. Staring at my coffee, unable to look him in the eye, I took a minute or so to contemplate what he'd said. His blast of wisdom had fragmented my thinking. Could I actually be hearing from God myself? I considered that possibility before I raised my head and looked Denver in the eye. "If you will be my friend, I promise I will not catch and release." "Then you got a friend forever, Mr. Ryan." Those were the words that haunted me now, as I prepared to leave town. For the last 19 months, during Debbie's battle with cancer, Denver had been at our home every day. Now she was gone, and the family was going away without him. I didn't want him to think I'd released him, but he wasn't answering his phone. He lived in the hobo jungle that no white man would dare to enter and live to tell about it. So sadly, we headed west on the interstate without ever telling him. Guilt rode shotgun for the next 400 miles.
Chapter 3. Mr. Schisler seen me in line for supper and told me Mr. Ron told him to tell me he'd gone on a retreat with his kids. I figured something done happened. Wasn't like him to not be calling or coming by to pick me up. But Lord have mercy, that man and his kids needed a break after caring for Miss Debbie the way they did. The funny thing is, Mr. Schisler laughed when he say the word retreat, 'cause he remembered the time Miss Debbie took me on a retreat. I'll never forget that day when she showed up at the mission in her big old white-on-white fancy something or another, about half the size of a bus, with four more white ladies in the back. "Anybody seen suicide?" she asked some of the homeboys sitting on the curb. They all pointed toward the hobo jungle, and she run across the street and right into the jungle like a hobo running from the law. I expect she'd be the first white lady ever to set foot in the jungle. I know she knowed how dangerous it was in them bushes, but she wasn't scared. "Denver?" I could hear her calling out in her pretty little voice. She hollered again, as I hung tight like a rabbit avoiding a coyote. I covered my head with a blanket, trying to keep her from finding me, 'cause I did not want to go to no retreat with a bunch of white ladies. But some fella, without saying a word, pointed his finger and ratted me out. She jerked that blanket off my head and grabbed my hand like I was a little boy and dragged me out of the bushes. Some of the homeboys seen what was going down, and they started snickering and singing, "Swing low, sweet chariot." You know, that's a funeral song. I seen them other white ladies in her SUV, and I started thinking about the time when three white boys put a rope round my neck and dragged me behind a horse for helping a white lady change a flat tire on a dirt road near the plantation. I was pretty sure they daddies was KKK. That was probably 50 years ago.
Until Miss Debbie, I ain't never again spoke to no white ladies. Not really. Except Sister Betty at the mission. But Sister Betty ain't no real white lady. She a colorblind, sure enough saint. I'm gonna tell you, I was sweating like a death row inmate strapped down in old Sparky as I wiggled my 6 foot, 275-pound self in the car with them ladies and headed out to a cabin in the woods for this retreat they've been telling me about. It was hard for me to believe none of their husbands was going with them, and even harder to believe them husbands would let their wives spend a weekend in a cabin with a dangerous, schizzy nigger like me. But Miss Debbie, she knowed what she was doing. 'Cause I come back a changed man, a free man, freed up from the devil's prison. That's when I almost told her what I still ain't told nobody.
Chapter 6. Denver was sitting on the curb dressed in clean slacks and shirt, surprisingly right on time. But then he'd confessed he'd been sitting there since sunup. After tacos at his favorite Mexican restaurant, we headed out to the ranch. He specifically asked to go there, but didn't say why. We started winding up the dirt road portion of Chestnut Mountain on the last leg of our journey when, for some reason, unprovoked, he started laughing so hard he had trouble catching his breath. He grabbed his chest over his heart, and I started to pull over, but he told me to keep driving. "What's so funny?" I asked. "Mr. Ron, ain't nobody ever going to believe our story. We got to write us a book." "Wait, what's this we? You don't read or write, so who is going to write your part?" "You know what I mean. I'm going to tell you my part, and you write it down. You already know your part, so write that down. And when we finish, we'll put the two together, and we'll have us a book." Debbie's horse, Rocky, ran along the fence like he was hoping it was her. She always brought him apples or carrots. We stopped at the barn, fed him and the others, and talked about the possibility of Denver's moving out to the ranch. He shot that down like a clay pigeon. He walked up the stairs to the big hayloft and sat down on a bale of alfalfa, then hollered down, "I like it up here. If you really want me staying out here at your ranch, then you can build me a little sleeping spot up here in the loft." Debbie would like that. That afternoon, I called an architect and asked him to make it a priority. He promised we could have it finished in no more than 6 months.
Chapter 7. Mr. Ron and me walked up to Miss Debbie's grave. He could see I'd been there, and he was happy about that. We sat on that big rock, staring at her grave without saying nothing. When I got to thinking to myself that this rich white man trusted me with his most valuable things, including his wife and cars, that just ain't normal. Miss Debbie and him are the onlyest people ever trusted me with anything. I sure enough didn't want to let them down. But I couldn't help wondering, if they knowed the real me, would they still be that trusting? Taking me to church and clubs and all they friends' mansions? I figured if they knowed, they'd have armed guards protecting them from me. I wish I'd met somebody like them back before things went down like they did. I told Mr. Ron I wanted to gather lots of rocks and build a wall around Miss Debbie's grave, make it a proper graveyard. He said he'd help, and we start the next morning. As the sun was going down, we sat on the big porch where it seemed to me you could look so far and see half of Texas. And California, too. I asked Mr. Ron if he was okay, and he said he was. But I knowed he was lying. The man didn't eat nothing. He just sat round in his shorts drinking wine and smoking them big cigars. Seemed to me he just want to die and get buried up there on the hill next to Miss Debbie. I don't really like it that I got to worry about somebody, but the man ain't nothing but a bag of bones. That night after supper, I was heading outside to sleep on the ground when Mr. Ron said he wasn't going to have none of that. He walked me up the stairs to Mr. Carson's room, showed me the bed and shower, and told me to sleep there. I'd been at that house many times before, but never to spend the night. Miss Debbie would try and make me stay, but I'd always find a way to slip off. Never in my life did I think I'd be sleeping in some white millionaire's house, using they toilet and shower. I ain't never knowed any colored folk that could boast about that. After I showered, I found me a patchwork quilt in the closet, like Big Mama used to make, and decided I'd sleep on the bed, not in it. It just seemed too personal, sleeping in white folks' bed. Now, I've been laying there quite a while with the cover over my face like everybody do in the jungle. That's so nobody can see who you is, in case somebody be looking for you. But I wasn't sleeping. Then the air started kind of whistling and stirring, like somebody was moving around in the room. Kind of scary. I got animal instincts that comes from living outside. I feels things normal folk can't feel. I was thinking maybe Mr. Ron was checking on me, making sure I slept where he told me to. You probably ain't gonna believe this, but the stirring air went stone cold silent and still. I laid there still as a dead man till a peace come over me. Through the quilt, I could see a bright light, like somebody flipped the switch, but they didn't. That light was big and round, and in the middle of it, the shape of a person was walking toward my bed. There weren't no footsteps, no noise at all, silent as a morgue after closing time. I felt her soft hand as she pulled the quilt off my face, and there she was, Miss Debbie, dressed in white like an angel, all healed up and pretty as ever. "Denver, you are always welcome to stay in our home." It was her voice for sure. "It ain't forgettable." "Thank you, Miss Debbie." Then she just evaporated like river fog at sunrise. It wasn't no dream, 'cause I ain't never gone to sleep. It was straight up a visitation from an angel, Miss Debbie.
Chapter 6. Denver was sitting on the curb dressed in clean slacks and shirt, surprisingly, right on time, though he confessed he'd been sitting there since sunup. After tacos at his favorite Mexican restaurant, we headed out to the ranch. He specifically asked to go there, but didn't say why. We started winding up the dirt road portion of Chestnut Mountain on the last leg of our journey when, for some reason, unprovoked, he started laughing so hard he had trouble catching his breath. He grabbed his heart, and I started to pull over when he told me to keep driving. "What's so funny?" I asked. "Mr. Ron, ain't nobody ever gonna believe our story. We got to write us a book." "What's this we? You don't read or write, so who is going to write your part? You know what I mean? I'm going to tell you my part, and you write it down. You already know your part, so write that down, and when we finish, we'll put the two together and we'll have us a book." Debbie's horse, Rocky, ran along the fence like he was hoping it was her. She always brought him apples or carrots. We stopped at the barn, fed him and the others, and talked about the possibility of him moving out to the ranch. He shot that down like a clay pigeon. He walked up the stairs to the big hayloft and sat down on a bale of alfalfa, then hollered down, "I like it up here. If you really want me staying out here at your ranch, then you can build me a little sleeping spot up here in the loft." Debbie would like that. That afternoon, I called an architect and asked him to make it a priority. He promised we could have it finished in no more than 6 months.
Chapter 7. Mr. Ron and me walked up to the cemetery. He could see I'd been there, and he was happy about that. We sat on that big rock, staring at her grave without saying nothing, and I got to thinking to myself that this rich white man trusted me with his most valuable things, including his wife and cars. That just ain't normal. Miss Debbie and him are the onlyest people that ever trusted me with anything. I sure enough didn't want to let them down. But I couldn't help wondering if they know the real me. Would they still be that trusting? Taking me to church and clubs and all their friends' missions? I figured if they had known, they'd have armed guards protecting them from me. I wish I'd met somebody like them years ago, before things went down like they did. I told him I wanted to gather lots of rocks and build a wall around Miss Debbie's grave. He said he'd help, and we could start the next morning. That night, after supper, I was heading outside to sleep on the ground when Mr. Ron said he wasn't going to have none of that. He walked me up the stairs to Mr. Carson's room, showed me the bed and shower, and told me to sleep there. I've been here before many times, but never to spend the night. Miss Debbie would try and make me stay, but I'd always find a way to slip off. Never in my life did I think I'd be sleeping in some white millionaire's house, using their toilets and shower. I ain't never known nary any colored folks that could boast about that. After I showered, I found me a patchwork quilt in the closet, like Big Mama used to make, and decided I'd sleep on the bed. Not in it. It just seemed too personal, sleeping in white folks' bed. Now, I'd been laying there quite a while with the covers over my face like everybody do in the jungle. That's so nobody can see who you is in case somebody be looking for you. But I wasn't sleeping. The air started kind of whistling and stirring like somebody was moving around in the room. Kind of scary. I got animal instincts that comes from living outside. I feels things normal folks can't feel. Maybe I was thinking Mr. Ron was checking on me, making sure I slept where he told me to. You probably ain't gonna believe this, but the staring air went stone cold, silent, and still. I laid there still as a dead man till a peace come over me. Through the quilt, I could see a bright light, like somebody had flipped a switch, but they hadn't. The light was big and round, and in the middle, a shape of a person was walking toward my bed. There weren't no footsteps, no noise at all, silent as a morgue after closing time. I felt her soft hand as she pulled the quilt off my face. And there she was, Miss Debbie, dressed in white like an angel, all healed up and pretty as ever. Denver, you are always welcome to stay in our home. It was her voice for sure. It ain't forgettable. Thank you, Miss Debbie. Then she just evaporated like a river fog at sunrise. It wasn't no dream, 'cause I had never gone to sleep. It was straight up a visitation from an angel, Miss Debbie.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.